Chapter 20, skipping down to verse 18.
All right.
It says, when the people saw the thunder and lightning and heard the trumpet and saw the mountain in smoke, they trembled with fear and they stayed at a distance. Remember, this was not a naturally occurring phenomenon from the standpoint of the thunder and the lightning and the smoke and the trumpet. Remember we talked about that last week? What they heard was a single trumpet blast that went on and on and on and kept getting louder. It did not stop. It was, if you can imagine what that would sound like, a trumpet blast that was not, did not have human origin, but just sounded, you know, and kept going and got louder as it went. In addition to, I mean, that's a little freaky anyway. And then you've got all this thunder. And you know, I don't know if you've ever been in a real thunderstorm. How many of you guys have like been to a place in the world that gets serious, respectable thunder? You know, just a few of you have. And that's great. You know, we've talked about this before. My kids are all kind of weenies because, you know, they were all raised here in the Pacific Northwest. And you know, we get thunder on occasion, but it's this just, and when we do, people all go, thunder. Oh, let me tell you, you know, if you haven't been in thunder that knocks you to your knees, you haven't really been in thunder. I mean, that is so loud that it breaks windows or rattles things around you, rattles things inside the house. You know, I am sure that the thunder of the Lord was just absolutely awe-inspiring as these people are gathering around Mount Sinai and the lightning is flashing. And remember something else that they heard. They heard the voice of God. Remember the Ten Commandments. You know, you watch the movie The Ten Commandments, you know, that was made, I think, back in the 50s. Wasn't it like something like Charlton Heston? We all have this picture in our mind. Charlton Heston is the quintessential Moses, you know. I mean, it's like, I know what Moses looks like. He looks a heck of a lot like Charlton Heston, actually. But, you know, but that movie just becomes the picture of what these things are to us, you know. And you see Charlton Heston going up on the mountain and you know, this lightning that rolls over and writes the Ten Commandments in the stone by the finger of God. And then he comes down the mountain and the people are all kind of partying, you know, because he's been on the mountain for a long time. Well, that's not how it happened. Moses did go up into the darkness, and there was just darkness around the mountain. But the people heard the voice of God speak the Ten Commandments. They audibly heard God speaking. All right? Probably somewhere around 2.5 million people. And they are scared out of their minds by what they have heard. In fact, it tells us here they stayed at a distance, but in look at verse 19 with me. It says that they said to Moses, listen, you speak to us yourself and we'll listen, but do not have God speak to us or we'll die. They're basically telling Moses, we don't want to hear him talk anymore. It was so frightening for them just to hear the voice of the Lord. So they told Moses, you talk to us. You be the intermediary between us and God. And we'll listen to you. We don't want to hear God talk anymore, or we will drop dead. They were so afraid. So Moses said to the people, do not be afraid. God has come to test you. Look at this. So that the fear of God will be with you to keep you from sinning. And by the way, that's what the fear of God is all about. The fear of God is an interesting thing, and people misunderstand it. They think of it as something akin to the fear of flying or the fear of heights or the fear of closed-in places or, you know what I'm saying, the fear of crowds. It's not like that. The fear of the Lord is not a fear that causes panic. It's a fear that drives us to live right, for lack of a better way of saying it, to holy living. Exactly what Moses says here, how he describes the fear of the Lord is really excellent when he says, he's come to test you so that you'll basically have the fear of God in your lives. And what that will do is it will keep you from sinning. When the Bible refers to a culture, like a nation, that is living however they want to live, doing whatever they want to do in terms of how they treat marriage, how they treat their children, how they treat human beings in general, how they treat money, how they do business. The Bible calls that culture a nation where there is no fear of God. And in fact, it'll say there was no fear of God in their eyes. It's a way of describing a lifestyle that lives without any fear of consequence or divine potential retribution or judgment, you know. In other words, there's no one who's going to hold me accountable for the way I live. So that means I can treat you any way I want to treat you, right? Think about morality for just a moment, if you would. Our country, which is getting farther and farther away from God, we're pushing God, you know, increasingly out of our institutions of learning, out of, you know, we've kicked it out of our schools. We've kicked it out of all public places for the most part. I mean, what's next? You know, kick it out of churches? The point is, when you'd have a culture like ours that increasingly takes God out of the equation, then you have to ask yourself the question, what is going to restrain that culture in the areas of immorality? You know? Well, you say, well, it'll have to just be civil laws. Yeah, but civil laws change. They come and go. And a person who's really a thinker can question whether or not the civil authorities even have the right to enact laws or to tell me that I can or can't do something. In other words, what right do they really even have to tell me that? The more a culture gets away from God, the more people question authority and question, why should these people even have any say-so in my life? I mean, who died and left them in charge? Sort of an attitude. It becomes more and more that way. We see that in our culture, don't we? I mean, good grief. You drive around, you know, somebody on their bumper, you know, question authority, it says. And they think they're being cool, but that's the attitude of a culture that is basically kicking God to the curb, essentially. And we will increasingly, we are already, and we will continue to be an increasingly lawless culture. You know? Lawlessness is at an all-time high. You know, thievery and oh, you name it. I mean, is divorce rising or going away? It's rising. We, you know, the whole attitude of how I treat my wife, how I treat my children, how I live my business. You know, corruption is on the rise and things like that. Why? There's no fear of God before their eyes. That's what how the Bible would describe it. You and I wouldn't say it that way. We would say that God is becoming less and less of any kind of a restraint. People believe that they are a biological accident, right? People believe that the reason they're here is because of an accident of nature. It just so happened that billions of years ago, this explosion in space took place called the Big Bang, and then over billions of years, you know, the whole evolutionary process came to be so that life emerged from the primordial soup and it crawled, slithered, whatever, onto land, and it evolved, and it eventually stood upright, and here we are. Well, you teach that to people, and what's their conclusion going to be? There's no purpose. Well, there's only one purpose. There's only one purpose in life. Happiness, personal happiness, right? And isn't that what you hear on television programs all the time? You have to make sure that you are happy. And if no one else makes you happy, you have to be happy. Sue and I were watching The Biggest Loser on TV the other day. And there's this one particular contestant, I guess, on the show who they were working on because of all her issues in her life and whatever, and Jillian was preaching to her, you know. Boy, she was preaching. I mean, that woman can preach. She's not a believer, but she can preach. And she was preaching the message of the culture. You have to be happy. You have to make yourself happy. If you don't make yourself happy, nobody will. And if other people in your life don't care about your happiness, then you got to take your happiness in hand and you just got to make sure you're happy. And it was just all this. It was just the sermon. It was the religion. People think they're not religious. Don't believe it for a second. You will adopt some form of religion. And if it doesn't come from the Bible, it'll come from the world. And they preach it just as surely, and they believe it based on a system of faith affirmations, just like any other thing. People love to say, "Oh, I'm not religious," and I say, "Bunk." From the standpoint of at least believing in a system of beliefs. Anyway, so. When God is taken out of the equation, personal happiness is really the only thing that there is to live for. And personal happiness begins to see itself as the ultimate goal apart from your personal happiness. I mean, if I have to step over you to be personally happy, well, that might just need to be what I have to do. Because you see, morality, once again, kind of goes out the window. It's because there's no fear of God in their eyes. So the fear of the Lord is a critical, fundamental first step to understanding really anything there is to understand about God. Check out this passage on the screen from Psalm 111. This is a great passage. It says, "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom." It's not all wisdom, but it's the beginning. And it says, "All who follow his precepts have good understanding." But it starts how? With the fear of the Lord. The fear of God. You know? Because what? It restrains the flesh. Every parent who's ever raised a child knows what the fear of God is because they have to convey it to their child in the form of who they are as a parent. I'm not going to necessarily make my child afraid of God, but I'm going to make them afraid of me from the standpoint of, you don't want to do that. Because if you do, you got me to deal with. Okay? That's called consequences. It's something we don't do much in parenting anymore today because we think it warps children. Well, let me tell you, that's just the opposite of the truth. So the reality is that every parent needs to teach their child, if they want their child to be obedient and law-abiding and understand the difference between right and wrong, they have to come to the point of teaching their child that you need to fear me more than the desire to do that thing that you want to do that I've told you not to do. That eventually gets processed from an understanding of God. And that fear of the Lord, fear of God, and the fear of consequences, truly, that I will be held accountable, is a governing sort of an attitude. Look at this other passage from Proverbs chapter 16. It says, "Through love and faithfulness, sin is atoned for, and through the fear of the Lord, a man avoids evil." You know, the fear of the Lord. So how do I describe the fear of the Lord in terms of, in maybe in practical terms that you can understand? Let's say that an angel appeared tonight worldwide and said that Jesus Christ was going to return in 1 week. Just imagine, this isn't going to happen, but just imagine that it did. How would you live that week? Knowing that Jesus was coming back. I mean, undeniably, this angel appears for all humanity to see. Jesus Christ will return in 1 week. You wouldn't go about business as usual. You wouldn't live the way you normally lived, and you'd be very careful about how you lived in that last week. That's the fear of God. That defines it. See, we are to live with an attitude that Christ's return is imminent. Not so that we will shrink and cower in fear, but so we will live our lives differently than we might if we think, "Oh, I got all the time in the world. I'll, you know, change my ways later." Jesus actually told parables, you know, about a master who had workers who worked in his fields. And the master told his workers, "I'm going to go away on a long trip. So he put them in charge to work the fields and do what they were supposed to do. And he went away. And eventually, after a long period of time, the servants, he said in this parable, began to say to themselves, you know, our master's been gone a long time. And he's probably going to continue to be gone for a long time. So they began to mistreat one another. And do all kinds of, you know, horrible things to one another. And then he says the master came back at a time they weren't expecting. And he made them, you know, give an account for their activity and their behavior. And he came back suddenly without expectation. Well, the whole parable is a picture of his own return and how people will tend to let go of morality when they think there's nothing to stand accountable to. You see? You know? And that is, again, there's no fear of God. And it all comes down to this concept of the fear of God. So it's something that I wanted to focus on because it's such a critical element of frankly our walk with the Lord. And again, the fear of God is not a cowering fear that makes me bite my fingernails and look over my shoulder and wonder if the sword is about to come out of nowhere and lop off my head. It's simply a healthy understanding that there are consequences to actions. Now, as a Christian, I know that my sins are forgiven. Okay? I know that there is no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. Why? Jesus was condemned in our place on the cross, correct? We know that. That's one of the reasons we don't cower in fear. But we do understand that there is still accountability. Okay? And so, there is not payment of sin for you and I, but there is accountability. Verse 21, let's pick it up. It says, the people remained at a distance while Moses approached the thick darkness where God was. And then the Lord said to Moses, tell the Israelites this, you've seen for yourselves that I have spoken to you from heaven. Do not make any gods to be alongside me. Do not make for yourselves gods of silver or gods of gold. They're actually going to do that. In the very near future to when he's saying this. Make an altar of earth for me and sacrifice on it your burnt offerings and fellowship offerings, your sheep and goats and your cattle. Wherever I cause my name to be honored, I will come to you and bless you. So he says, for those sacrifices that you make, and remember, the whole sacrificial system of the Old Testament simply was a pointer to the coming Messiah who would die in our place. So these animals would die on an altar in the place of the worshiper, the individual coming to God, and it was teaching them forgiveness by sacrifice, a stand-in, if you will. And God says, I want you to build this altar out of just simple earth. Did you notice that? He says, don't make it, in fact, he's going to say here in verse 25, don't make it fancy. Look what he says. If you make an altar of stones for me, do not build it with dressed stones. That's a way of just kind of saying finely carved, ornamented stones. And look what he says, for you will defile it if you use a tool on it. What is he saying there? What's God saying to the people? Don't make the altar fancy. He understands something about human nature. When something is fancy, we get to looking at it like it's special. And then it goes through a period of time where it's considered special. Well, first it's just functional. I mean, an altar of stones that are just rocks out of the river, you put those together to make an altar, there's nothing, you know, it's just functional. But if you dress it up and, you know, put some gold in there and do some carving, oh, now it's special. And then after it's special for a while, it becomes sacred. And then after it's sacred for a little while, it then becomes holy. And then after it's been holy for a while, we start to worship it. We literally start to care more about that thing than we do the God that it was supposed to point us to. Now we're being pointed to the thing. And we start almost worshiping the thing, caring about the thing more than we do God. Why is that? Why? It's human nature. It's human nature. So God says to the people, when you make an altar, make it really simple. Don't make it fancy at all. You know, guys, I got to tell you something. It's one of the reasons I love our building here at Calvary Chapel. I mean, this is a glorified onion shed, and really not all that glorified. Do you know that a gal came to me, she came to me after a service, and if it was you and you're here or you're listening online, I don't even remember your name, so don't be offended. But this woman came to me and she said, you know, I decided to kind of come and check out your church and that sort of thing. She goes, my husband won't come because he thinks the building's ugly on the outside. I said, well, it is, you know. Yeah, I mean, it looks like any other onion shed you might drive by, you know. I mean, it kind of looks like a church with an onion shed over here. But you know what we've done to churches over the years? We've venerated them. We've made them special. It's like, and we even taught our kids, some of you people that are older might remember. Remember, we kid would run in church. We say, don't run in church. As if God's going to strike you dead if you run in church. You know, the reason you don't run in church is you might knock somebody over. That's why. It's not because this building, a church building, should never be holy. There's nothing holy about them. They're gathering places, and they will burn one day. You know? You want to know what's holy? You are. You are the church. You are the body of Christ. You're what's special. And you know what? God thinks you're special whether you're meeting in a cathedral or whether you're meeting in a barn. Or whether you're meeting in an open field because there's no place to meet, or under a tree, it's you who's special. But we begin to do this, and it's just this crazy, weird thing that we do. So God, I love how God, you know, knows, obviously understands human nature. Don't make it fancy. Don't make it special. We need to remember that as a church. How many sacred cows have churches adopted and maintained? And then you ask them why, and they go, well, we've always done it that way. Well, that's a good reason to get rid of it. You know? Just, you made it sacred. This is not the focus of why we're here. Jesus is the focus of why we're here. Not what we've created with our own hands. We begin to worship what we've tooled. Oh, isn't that pretty? Oh, isn't that gorgeous? Get rid of it. You know? Anyway, I love this next thing. It just ends on the last verse of Exodus 20. He simply says, and do not go up to my altar on steps, lest your nakedness be exposed on it. Let me tell you what that's all about. It was a very common thing for pagans to think that the higher you got, the closer you were to God. That was a pagan mindset. So if anybody tells you that we like to go up in the mountains where we're close to God, just say, you pagan. No, don't do that. They might not appreciate it. But it really was a pagan idea of the closer you are. That's why later on when Israel began to worship pagan gods, God would confront them and say, you commit adultery on every hill. They would actually go up on the hills, you know, as pagans and worship the pagan gods there. So we understand as Christians, God's Spirit, you know, what did David say? If I go to the heights, there you are. If I go to the deepest depths, there you are too. You're everywhere. He understood that. But the pagans, of course, loved to build high altars that you had to crawl up with steps or on a ladder to go and do your little thing, because if you're way up in the air, it just looks holy, I suppose. And so God said, listen, when you build me an altar, just lose the steps, okay? Because first of all, that's pagan thinking. And second of all, the way you guys dress, it's not good. You know? And you don't want to be going up to worship God and have that kind of stuff going on. Just lose the steps and we'll all be good. Yeah, I like it. So, great. Chapter 21. God is going to begin to establish specific laws pertaining to everyday life and so forth. And he says to Moses, these are the laws you are to set before them. First of all, he says, if you buy a Hebrew servant, your Bible may say slave, because the word can go either way. He is to serve you for 6 years, but in the seventh year he shall go free without paying anything. Stop there. People who don't understand slavery and servitude from a biblical perspective get whacked out when they read verses like this, and they say, this really creeps me out because it looks to me very much like God is advocating slavery. Well, first of all, you have to understand that it's not slavery anything close to what slavery was here in the United States even. They didn't go out and bus people in from some other country and, you know, make them slaves. This was basically indentured servitude. And if you know what that means, that's debt reducing type servitude. Here's what would happen. From time to time, someone would get themselves into debt. And they didn't have a bankruptcy policy back then. So what they would do is whoever to whom you owed the money, if you could no longer pay, or it looked to the that you were never going to be able to pay this debt off, you would then sell yourself to that individual to be their indentured servant. And you would then work off the debt. What that means is you would not, for that period of time, wouldn't be making any money personally. It was the master's responsibility to feed you and to give you a place to live. Isn't that interesting? So the master had responsibilities. He had to, you know, house and clothe you, but everything, of course, you made went to paying off the debt. You made no money. And usually indentured servitude came after you gave away everything that was yours. So you didn't have anywhere to live anyway. You gave away everything. You gave away all your animals. You sold your fields. You tried paying off your debt, but you still couldn't. So you had to sell yourself into this indentured servitude. All right. What God is saying here to the Jews is, when one of your fellow Hebrews is so down on his life, I was going to say luck, but we know there's no such thing. It's a phrase, though. That he has to sell himself to you to pay off a debt. Here's what I want you to do. You allow him to work for 6 years to pay that off. But wherever that debt is at the end of 6 years, you set your brother free. Even if he still owes you the lion's share of what you lent him, set him free. And it was kind of like a Sabbath year, that on that seventh year, he goes free regardless. It's a pretty cool thing when you stop and think about it. But what it was meant to do was obviously meant to be an act of mercy and grace to those who were in debt. But it was also a way of telling money owners, be careful how much money you're lending too. Because if you see someone who's wanting to borrow all this money, understand that if this person gets to the point where they can no longer repay, he will only have 6 years in which to pay back that debt. And after that point, you're out. But see, that's your responsibility now because you knew the law of the land. After 6 years, boom, you set this guy free. Debt is paid, right? Well, you know, it's really not a bad system. Not only were they to set them free, but remember, the indentured servant would have nothing after that 6 years with which to carry on life or to begin his own life once again. So we're the master in this case is told in the book of Deuteronomy to be generous after that 6 years. Check out this passage from Deuteronomy chapter 15. Look what this says. And when you release him, do not send him away empty-handed. Supply him liberally from your flock, your threshing floor, and your wine press. Give to him as the Lord your God has blessed you. Isn't that great? What a great principle. It's a principle of generosity. God has blessed you. Bless him. Now, think about this, guys. This is a little weird. This guy has gotten himself into debt. He sells everything, still can't pay it off, has to come and work for you. He works for 6 years. The seventh year, you're obligated by law to release him. His debt remains unpaid. There's still some debt remaining. You know that you're losing on this equation, and yet God commands you to be generous at the end of that 6 years and send that guy out so he can start over again. And he won't starve. Do you see the mercy of God in these verses? You know, people all the time, they read through the Old Testament, they go, you know, I don't really like reading through the Old Testament. It's just so much killing, and it seems like God's just always so ticked. You know, he's always angry. He's always killing people and opening up the ground and swallowing them up. And there's snakes and plagues and stuff like that. And they, I don't like the Old Testament. The Old Testament's a drag. No, the Old Testament's actually full of God's mercy. Yeah, there are judgments. Yes, I'll be honest with you. But what do you see right here? God is factoring into the Mosaic Law, which was the system of socioeconomic life in Israel. Be merciful, be generous with your fellow man. If we treated people like this, I think it would be a good thing. I think it would be a good thing, honestly. Look with me what it goes on to say. If this man who's this indentured servant, if he comes alone to you, then he should go free alone after that 6-year period. But it says if he has a wife when he comes, she is to go with him. However, if the master gives him a wife, meaning he provides a wife from one of his other servants, and she bears him sons or daughters, the woman and her children shall belong to her master, and only the man shall go free. All right? Now, what it doesn't say right here, which we do find elsewhere in the Mosaic Law, is that the man would have the right to redeem his wife and children from the master. He could pay to get them out of their servitude as well. But you can imagine very few men would probably want to leave their wife and their children. So there was actually something in the law to take care of them if they liked their master. Look at verse 5. It says, but if the servant declares, I love my master and my wife, not as much as my wife, but he's an okay guy. And I love my children and I don't want to go free. Then his master must take him before the judges. He shall take him to the door or the doorpost and pierce his ear with an awl. Then he will be his servant for life. All right, stop there. This was the provision for the bond servant, or also referred to as the bond slave. It was meant for the servant who recognized that, you know, the reason I got myself into debt is I'm really not a good farmer, or I'm really not a good businessman on my own. I'm really not. And I got myself into all kinds of debt, all kinds of trouble. And you know, by the grace of God, I got myself indebted to this man, and I worked for him for 6 years. And now he's ready to let me go because it's starting the 7th year. But I don't want to go. I've actually got a good thing with this guy. He really likes me, and he treats me well. And it's just like working for a really, really good employer. You know, I like the benefits I've got. He treats me kindly. He's given me a wife. With that wife, I've had children. I want to stay. I don't think I could do any better on my own. I want to stay. So God made a provision for that. Fine, great. Just go and tell your master, listen, I don't want to go. I want to keep working for you. You're a good guy. I'll keep working hard for you. No problem. He said, take him before the judges so that they understand in a collective gathering of people that this is the agreement, that he's not being coerced. He really, truly wants to do this. And then he's to pierce his ear. Interesting kind of a sign, isn't it? And to say he is now a bond servant or a bond slave of the master, meaning I am joyfully committed to this man for the rest of my life, and I will be his servant. It's a pretty cool concept, isn't it, when you stop and think about it? It's a great provision. Here's what's really interesting. In the New Testament, Paul, Peter, Jude, and James all introduce themselves in their letters by their first name, and then said, I am a bondservant of Jesus Christ. My ear has been pierced, spiritually speaking, and I am in debt to my master for life, and I will never leave him because I've never had it better in my life. He gave his life for me, and I give my life to him. What's interesting about those four individuals that I named for you is that two of them, James and Jude, were the earthly half-brothers of Jesus. Born of Mary, their father was Joseph, and they went on to become well-known, and in some cases even leaders in the early church. But they came to a place in their lives where Big Brother was no longer Big Brother. He is the Lord Jesus Christ. And I, you know, neither James or Jude came out in their letters and said, James, brother of Jesus. As if that was kind of a pedigree, you know. I would have done that, but they didn't. I mean, I'd have been looking for some cheers on that one. You really? You were raised with the Lord?
Yeah.
Come on over sometime for dinner. I'll tell you stories. It'll end up in apocryphal works somewhere along the lines. But, you know, it's just they were so humble. And I'm so blessed by that. Their humility. James, a bond slave of Christ. Jude actually introduced himself as the brother of James, a bondservant of Christ. Isn't that great? I am a lifetime servant. Wow. Verse 7 says, if a man sells his daughter as a servant, she's not to go free as men servants do. Now, stop there. Before you judge this statement, you need to understand that there's more to it than just a woman being sold into servitude. Back in those days, when a man wanted his, if he was poor, but I want my daughter, let's say this, there's a man who's fairly well-to-do, and he wants to marry my daughter. Well, that's good. I want my daughter to marry her because he's got money. But see, as a dad, I would have to pay the bride price to this individual. If I can't afford that, and the bride price was sometimes paid by the father, he would sometimes put his daughter in service to that individual to pay that bride price leading up to the marriage. So this is a betrothal, okay? And we find that here as we go on and read the next verse. It doesn't look like it in verse 7, but you look in verse 8 and it says, if she does not please the master, look at this, who has selected her for himself. Okay? He must let her be redeemed. He has no right to sell her to foreigners. Why? Because he's broken faith with her. People, that idea of breaking faith is a marital term. Now, it means they're not married yet, but they're betrothed. And she's coming to work as a servant because her father is too poor. And during that time, if the man says, you know, I don't want to marry your daughter after all. Well, he's broken faith with her. And she has to be able to be redeemed. She cannot be sold as a slave to foreigners and that sort of thing. So this was put in place to protect women. Now, you and I might read something like this and go, yeah, but you know, that's still a little bit ditzy. It's a little strange. I'll grant you, from our societal perspective, some of the things that are said about women might, to you and I, sound a little weird, but you need to understand something. You need to understand that at the time that this was being given, at the time that this was written, women were considered property. And for that reason, they were essentially a non-person. Now, God never advocates that. In the Word of God, people think that that's what's going on, but it's not. In fact, we see, particularly here in the Mosaic Law, God bending over backwards to protect women. And this is one example right here. When a woman goes to serve this man who she's eventually going to marry, and he decides he doesn't want her, he can't just toss her away. He can't sell her for a profit to some foreigners who happen to be going by. And it'll be considered as if he broke faith with her. That means that there will be a stigma on his life for having kind of used this woman in a disrespectful manner. Okay? This is something God is putting in the law, again, to protect the lives of women. And then we're told here in verse 10, no, I'm sorry, I didn't give you verse 9 yet. If that master selects her for his son, he had no intention of marrying her himself, but he actually selects her for his son, he must grant her the rights of a daughter. What is that saying? Remember, she comes as a servant because her father's too poor. So she comes to serve, and he selected her for his son. She's working off this bride price thing, and it says that once they marry, he has to treat her like he would a daughter-in-law, no longer a servant. Again, meant to protect the woman. It says in verse 10 that if he marries another woman, so let's say he does marry this woman, but then he goes on and marries another woman, he must not deprive the first one of her food, clothing, and marital rights. Now, this provision protects the woman in the case of polygamy, which, by the way, I want to remind you, was never God's intention for man. Polygamy was never something God intended people to do. They did it apart from the Lord, and God bore with it for a season, but it was never his intention, all right? But he also didn't just ignore it. He put laws in place to protect those who were subjected to that kind of rotten social organization in the family. And he is saying here once again to protect this woman that if this woman is subjected to a polygamous family where he takes another wife, by law, according to the Mosaic law, this man is not to mistreat this woman. He is to continue to treat her and accord her all the rights of a wife. All right? In fact, look at verse 11. It says, if he, once again the master, does not provide her with these three things, she is to go free without the payment of money. In other words, she instantly gains her freedom if this woman, is subjected to this sort of a thing. He does not have any further rights because he broke faith with her. All right, now we're going to deal with some issues where injury might be the result. Verse 12, anyone who strikes a man and kills him shall surely be put to death. These are the guidelines that God gave in the Mosaic Law for capital offenses, when there was a capital crime. And by the way, much of our own law, civil law, is based on these basic precepts within the Mosaic Law. And it says that murder is at the top of those who are going to deserve the death sentence. And it's because life is sacred. Verse 13, however, if he does not do it intentionally, but God lets it happen, he is to flee to a place I will designate. Now, later, God would have Moses designate some cities in Israel, which he referred to as the cities of refuge. And there would be sprinkled throughout Israel, so they'd be easy to get to. If someone accidentally killed someone, this individual could flee to the city of refuge where he was to be protected by the inhabitants of that city from anyone who might try to bring vengeance or get vengeance on this individual until his case could be heard. Basically, what God is establishing here is a trial, is to determine the guilt of this individual by trial. That's what's going on here. So he's saying, if this individual didn't mean to do this, he can go to the city of refuge where he can wait and have his case heard out. He will be protected. And if it is considered that he is innocent of murder, which is a premeditated desire to kill someone, then, it will be a whole different situation. Verse 14 says, but if a man schemes and kills another man deliberately, take him away from my altar and put him to death. And our law calls this premeditated murder. Our law calls this murder in the first degree. And it is something that still carries the death penalty in some places today. Elsewhere, God says about murder. Let me show you a passage from Numbers, chapter 33, or 35 rather. Look at this. God says, do not accept a ransom for the life of a murderer who deserves to die. He must surely be put to death. Do not pollute the land where you are. Bloodshed pollutes the land, and atonement cannot be made for the land on which blood has been shed except by the blood of the one who shed it. This is, again, much of what is behind our nation's original laws on capital punishment. There was a belief that murder was not just wrong. You didn't just wrong the individual whose life you took away, or you didn't just wrong the family of the person of whose life you took away. What you did, the crime you committed, affected everyone. It literally, as the Bible says here, polluted the land. And you were guilty of polluting the land. And God speaks in the Old Testament about a people who had so polluted their land that the land eventually vomited them out. And that's, it's weird word picture that is fairly graphic and even a bit creepy, but it conveys a sense of what is real. And this is something, frankly, that our culture has, with our privatization mentality today, we've gotten completely away from. Completely away from. How many times, let me just tell you this. If you get into a conversation with someone about morality, here's what they will say. If what I do doesn't hurt anybody else, it's not wrong. Okay? Now, first of all, what they're kind of saying, too, is that morality is what I think is moral and what is immoral. It doesn't really matter, you know. There's really nothing above me. We're equals, me and you. There's no power above me that declares morality. I basically set my own morality. And if what I say is moral doesn't hurt anybody, then you have no right to call it immoral. And it doesn't, you know, and they'll even say, how am I hurting you by doing this? Well, one of the things that you see in the Old Testament is that we are not an island unto ourselves as far as human beings go. What we do affects people around us, affects our families, affects our neighbors, affects other, you know, relatives or whatever. What we do affects people. It affects our cities, our states, our nation, our world. We are not an island. You are not this little privatized entity that can live your life any way you want, because it doesn't affect you. It doesn't hurt anybody. Hey, if what I do doesn't hurt you, who cares? Well, God cares. And he tells us, first of all, that it does have an effect. There is a pollution process that goes culturally into the fabric of our culture that has a corrupting influence. And it's huge. In verse 15, it says that anyone who attacks his father or his mother must be put to death. Wow. So it was a capital crime to attack. And by the way, attack is considered in context here to mean to the point of death, or possibly with the intent to kill. And this would obviously be a gross violation of the fifth commandment to honor your father and mother. More capital punishment crimes. Anyone who kidnaps another and either sells him for profit or still has him when he is caught must be put to death. Crazy, huh? Kidnapping. Capital offense. A capital offense to kidnap someone. Criminally enslaving, apparently, in God's eyes is not far from murder. Verse 17. Anyone who curses his father or mother must be put to death. Isn't that interesting? Now, let me just make another point here. From Deuteronomy, we learn that a parent did not have the right to carry out punishment against their child. In other words, if a parent decided they hated their child, they couldn't just kill him because, you know, you cursed me or something like that. It had to come before the elders and the judges of the city. But in this situation, it was even considered a capital crime. It says, if men quarrel and one hits the other with a stone or with his fist and he does not die, notice that, but he is confined to bed, the one who struck the blow will not be held responsible, at least from a murder standpoint, if the other gets up and walks around outside with his staff. However, here's what he is responsible for. He has to pay the injured man for the loss of his time and see that he's completely healed. So, in the case of two men who get in a brawl and one man hurts the other one, you know, he doesn't die. So you're not going to be considered, obviously, a murderer because you didn't murder the guy, but you are responsible for his lost productivity, and you must attend him and see that he, you know, you must pay. If there's money to be paid, both for his well-being, his family, and to get him back on his feet again, it's your responsibility. So the law was protecting lost productivity of someone resulting from a physical altercation. Isn't that interesting now? Our government completely got away from that. I like some of these ideas, frankly. You know, today, you guys, if we have an altercation and somebody gets hurt and crippled, the government just takes over. The government says, we will take care of this person for the rest of their life. Under the Mosaic Law, the person who did it has to take care of them. That's called restitution. I like restitution. I think that's putting the responsibility where the responsibility should go. If a man beats his male or female slave with a rod and the slave dies as a direct result, he must be punished. So that he's going to, you know, that's capital murder. I mean, that's, he's going to be punished for that. But it goes on to say, but he's not to be punished if the slave gets up after a day or two, since the slave is essentially his property. Now, again, please don't think God is advocating or even allowing the mistreatment of servants and slaves, because we're not going to have time to get into it tonight. But when we get to the next chapter, God is going to wrap this statement up by saying, do not mistreat people. Do not mistreat foreigners. You lived in a foreign land once and you were mistreated. Don't do that to others. They were not ever to mistreat one another. And, you know, it was never okay to do that. What we don't understand from this passage is we don't know why the master might even be going after the servant with a rod. For all we know, he's protecting another one of his servants. Maybe this wild servant is attacking some of the others, threatening to kill them. Maybe the servant had to go after him and punish him for that. We don't know. But what we're going to see in verses later on in the next chapter is that ultimately all mistreatment is never okay. It goes on. Verse 22. If men who are fighting hit a pregnant woman and she gives birth prematurely, but there's no serious injury, meaning to mother or child, then the offender must be fined whatever the woman's husband demands and the court allows. But if there is serious injury, meaning to death to the woman or the child or injury, then he says, you are to take life for life. In fact, he goes on to describe this kind of commensurate system of justice. Eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, bruise for bruise. We're going to end with this, but have you ever heard the term an eye for an eye? I'm sure we all have. This is where it comes from. It comes from the Bible. But what's interesting is when you hear people say it today, it's always a justification for revenge. They will get revenge and then come back and say, "Yeah, well, eye for an eye." Do you know why God put it in the law? It was to keep revenge from being overly vengeful. It was to keep human nature from doing what it wants to do. You knock out my tooth, I cut off your head. Right? You steal my ox, I burn down your house. You kidnap my daughter, you know, I kill all your kids. You see? God instituted an eye for an eye to be a commensurate, fair system of justice. You cannot go beyond what was taken from you. In the specific sense of this injury sort of a thing. We're going to find that he's going to put some extra, in the next chapter, he's going to add some extra things to people who are guilty of a crime of like thievery and that sort of thing. But when someone has wronged you personally in this way, you know, you insulted me, so, you know, I tortured your son. You can't do that. An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth teaches fairness. Fair compensation, you know, whereas, again, human tendency wants to do worse to those who have hurt us.